Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Mark White. We have a special episode for you this time. This is an episode on Nathan Bedford Forrest. Mr. Forrest is somewhat of a polarizing person in our history here in Memphis, but we're going to try and get down to the truth of it and pass the rumors and all the other things that you've heard. Many, many years of research have gone into this by the people that you're going to hear here in just a few minutes, and I really hope that this helps to talk a little bit more about this, open up the discussion, and also just to get kind of a little bit down to the truth of what this man was. So anyway, let's get started.
All right, guys, welcome to the show. I want to go around the table and have everybody introduce themselves and talk a little bit about themselves, and then we'll get started. Doug?
My name is Doug Couples. I'm a retired historian. I taught at several colleges and universities. I primarily focus on American history, Southern history, the War for Southern Independence, as well as general military and naval history of the United States.
I didn't think there was anything such as a retired historian, but we'll go with that.
I don't draw a salary anymore.
Yeah. Understood.
I'm Joe Lowry, and I co-produce OurMemphisHistory.com, and I specialize in the history side of OurMemphisHistory.com.
Yes, you do.
I'm Lee Miller, longtime historian, commentator, author. I've been a guest lecturer at seven universities on American history and specializing in War Between the States history.
And I'm Alan Doyle. I'm a lifelong Memphian, graduated from the Memphis State University, a businessman here in town, and I'm a forest historian. That's my niche.
All right, well, let's get started.
Nathan Bedford Forrest was such a unique person that there's a lot of things to his life, besides being a military genius, one of the most admired American generals of all time. But his entire life is just something really, really special that hardly compares with a lot of other lives, particularly of his time. Raised in Chapel Hill, a teenager, moved to Salem, Mississippi, and then his father passed away, putting Bedford Forrest as the man of the house at that point as just a teenager, all taking care of his younger siblings and older brother. And then he just had to fend for himself to provide for the family. After living in Salem, Mississippi, they moved to Hernando, Mississippi, and they had several different episodes there, which really formed his life, developed his life, and forced him into becoming a leader, because he was the leader of the family. There he got into, they had a small farm, got into buying and selling horses a little bit, had a livery stable. Then his uncle Jonathan, his father's brother, Jonathan, lived there as well, and dealt in horses and livestock. And Bedford got involved with that, and that's really where his business acumen really showed. That he was an excellent businessman, buying and selling, trading, got into real estate, buying and selling farmland. And as his own little family farm got bigger, then he had to he added to that more land, and then consequently more livestock. So he was just his natural ability developed him as a person, a businessman, a leader there on the frontier south of Memphis, there just things expanded, and he ultimately moved to Memphis, to the big city of Memphis, to further his business dealings there.
Yeah, his first introduction to business was actually in Hernando with the livery stable with Uncle Jonathan. He also married in Hernando in 1845. But in addition to the livery stable, he also had a brickyard, a stagecoach line to Memphis, and he also tried to build a school in Hernando that almost got off the ground but didn't quite get done from a financing standpoint. When he did move to Memphis, he immediately was investing in real estate, commercial mostly. But he also owned two plantations in Mississippi, the largest one being in Cahoma County, Mississippi, and a second one in Tunica County. He retired from the slave trade early, prior to 1860, and then enlisted as a private in the Confederate Army, Provisional Army of Tennessee, rather, June 14th, 1861.
I would like to say something about Forrest that I don't think many people ever really get to. And I think one of his main characteristics is he was just innately intelligent. He did not have much formal education. And if you look at the Tennessee Civil War Veterans questionnaires, you'll see that most people had a rudimentary education and not much beyond that. But Forrest had a good rudimentary education. And I think he once said he might not spell things correctly, but he spelled them as they sounded. And so he was an extremely intelligent man. And as a member of the Memphis City Council, or Board of Aldermen, as it was called at that time, Forrest was almost immediately placed in charge of the treasury and the finances. So I think that brings out his second characteristic. I want to talk about an intelligence, just innate intelligence. And I think the ability to learn quickly. I don't think they had IQ tests as we now know them today, although sometimes you'll see a book or someone say, well, Napoleon's IQ was this, which is, I think, pretty garbage to try and apply that type of science. But if you take a look, and it's not just as his war record, which I think is a reflection of that, he learned the basics and the advanced technology very quickly, very thoroughly, and he was that way on the city commission, Board of Aldermen. And the other thing I think was his high sense of honesty. He's placed in charge of the money. There are several accounts in a number of books and articles about touring the levee and the cobblestones once. Of course, the levee and the cobblestones was the heartbeat of Memphis, the commercial heartbeat at least. And the other member of the Board of Aldermen came up with a scheme that would allow some excess money to be able to be floated among other commissioners, and Forrest threatened to thrash him right then and there if he went to fraud and deception. So I think, again, his innate intelligence, his ability to learn, high IQ, his honesty and his ability to manage money and figures. The next thing, I think, and picking up on what Alan was saying here, he was very ambitious. He did come from hard times, but I would not call them hardscrabble poor. They were, I think, fairly typical of farms throughout West Tennessee and North Mississippi. They had a very strong mother, and he was looking for a way to become a planter. That was kind of the social status of the day. If you could meet those levels of income, land ownership, I'm reminded of Michelle Harrow in Gone with the Wind, where he says, "Why can't you scarlet O'Hara, land is the only thing that matters, the only thing worth dying for." And I think that is pretty true among most people, and I think this is very American. The pioneers came over here, both southern and northern parts of the country, and the goal was to own your own land because you were not going to own it in Europe. And so Forrest had many of the same characteristics as his neighbors, but he was extremely industrious and had the intelligence and the wherewithal to just go out and do it. And I think these are characteristics that served him well in war, served him well in city government, and served him well in business. His whole idea, of course, we know that becoming a slave dealer is going to come up, and it's a part of his history, but it was more for him as a stepping stone to other more respectable planters, owning land, planting cotton, became very successful there. So I think what we have in Forrest is a man very much at the frontier. He was able, very capable of protecting himself. If you pose a threat to his life, his family's life, or harm to them, he had no qualms with killing you very quickly and getting it over with. He took no joy in it. I don't think he ever took joy in killing. Nothing ever indicates that. But I think he realized the nature of where he was and what the stakes were. and he had the ability to do it. And he did rise to become a planter. So I think all of these things are characteristics that are so often overlooked, and I think they are the characteristics that carried on through the early war and in a military fashion during the war and then after the war. And the final thing I want to say about his character, I think he comes out of all of these. He's an extremely pragmatic man. I don't think he was into the war because he wanted to kill. He was into the war, as he said, to secure an independent Southern Republic. He did everything he could to achieve that. But when they had lost, he said, okay, it's over. I love the old flag as much as I ever did. And he also volunteered to lead troops in Cuba and some of the disturbances down there. But I think it was Grant that turned him down, so we don't really need you. Or Sherman or Grant. But I think these are characteristics we often see very little of. I don't really think he enjoyed killing for the sake of killing. It was a necessity for him. And if you look at Memphis in this area at that time, all the upper class citizens went armed. I've seen accounts of the mayor of Memphis and someone who said he owed him a debt or something like that trading gunshots down there on Monroe. We know that a number of Bolton, who was a pretty notorious factor, was murdered in Court Square. Smithy Bankhead was a lawyer who codified the city's laws for the very first time. Bankhead's annotated. He was murdered.
Mysteriously murdered.
So I think these are characteristics that are too often overlooked. When he converted to the faith, he converted both feet in and became a devout Christian member of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church.
Right. I think, as you mentioned, Dr. Couples, the frontier life forced you to have to take action when necessary. And Forrest was certainly one to jump right in there if the situation required it. One episode in Hernando, four men kind of jumped his uncle Jonathan, and they had broke out into a gunfight. Uncle Jonathan was killed, but Forrest won the gunfight. But afterwards, he was, I guess, kind of sorry it happened. And ultimately, one of those the brothers on the other side was a member of his own cavalry, Forrest Cavalry. So they made up afterwards. But he had a quick, sharp temper, but he got the job done. And then business as usual. Then you moved on.
The temper flared, and then it came down. Let me mention one more incident relates to the war, and then I will pass on to someone else. There was, I believe it was in Columbia, Tennessee, when the young Lieutenant Gould, an artilleryman, had been chastised by Forrest and hadn't given him the credit. I think that's the correct officer, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And he thought he deserved, and he hunted the general down in his where his headquarters were, with the intent of getting satisfaction. And he shot Forrest. And Forrest pinned him down with his one arm and took his other hand and took his pocket knife out and opened it with his teeth and stabbed the young man. And they finally separated him, carried Gould across the street where he was dying, and they assured Forrest that his wound was not fatal, but Gould's was. And then Forrest insisted on being taken to him, where they made up, and he was very, very
apologized to each other,
very sorrowful. So yes. He's a man, I think, of, like we say, quick temper, quick to calm down, and intense emotions. I think we see that also in his attitude towards women.
Yes. After moving to Memphis, of course, Forrest was still operating farmlands in Mississippi, and as they grew, he required labor. He started out with two or three slaves, and then added that to run the farms, and then just discovered that was a natural extension of dealing in real estate and livestock. It was a booming economy, and the planters in the area, in the region, needed labor, and so the slave trade kind of grew, and Forrest got involved in that in 1852. Marianne didn't think too highly of that, his wife. And So Forrest was in it for just a few years, just about six or seven years, and he got out. But he made a lot of money doing it, but it was just an expansion of his just natural business interests that he got into the slave trade at all.
It was interesting that a lot of the current historians describe him as a yeoman planter, as opposed to one of the planter gentry at that time, which means he came up from his bootstraps, built his own farm, didn't inherit land, and didn't inherit slaves like many of the antebellum planters did. So he was definitely a self-made man in that regard.
Let me piggyback on that, Alan. I didn't mean to interrupt you, if you would. But I think you're exactly right. But he had his sights at the top, and I think it's safe to assume, and more than assume, it's more or less a fact, that the war, when it broke out, was a war between two republics, both of them where slave owning was legal. And there were all sorts of debates going on about the legality and the morality of it, but it was legal. And Forrest was one who was willing to take advantage of the legal situation as it was. And one of the great needs in Memphis, and Joe, you may be aware of this already, was Memphis was kind of a way station. The black population of Memphis was only 9 to 12%. So Memphis served as a stop on the way as in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s.
A transfer point.
Yeah, slaves were being relocated from Virginia where the tobacco crops were playing out, and moved through, of course, Louisville and Cincinnati and on down the Mississippi. And what they were doing was, of course, finding a place to house the slave population. You couldn't just put in a crowd like they were doing a lot of other industry or warehouse. There had to be some type of facilities. And that's what I think Forrest started out becoming involved in. But of course, he was a trader. He bought and sold slaves. And I think we all realize that the reality of it doesn't make it a moral right. And I think we all assume right now today, but that was a legal situation between both countries. It was a legal institution. And Forrest, I think, had a high sense of loyalty to the law and government. He served, but he would take advantage of it, being the pragmatist that I think he was, while it was legal. And I think if anyone's going to relate to the Paul Bearer speech or his address to his men at the surrender, that pragmatic nature, I think, comes forth very strongly in the address to his men. I mean, you're familiar with that, I'm sure.
Well, if you look at Forrest's life in relation to African Americans, the colored population, Forrest's opinion changed. It developed. They were. The slave trade, the slaves were essentially property, but when Forrest got into fighting in the war between the states, the war for Southern independence, he had a number of blacks in his cavalry. He started out, took 44 slaves of his own slaves with him, and said that if they would serve in his cavalry as teamsters, etc., that he would free them after the war. But interesting to note that halfway through the war, General Forrest decided if something happened to him, he didn't want anything to untoward to happen to his slaves. So he freed all 44 slaves and told them they could go home. Well, 43 of them turned around and enlisted in the Confederate cavalry right there. Only one went home. He was so well respected among the black population that those men stayed with him and were Confederate cavalrymen. And he enlisted other cavalrymen. Holt Collier was one. Polk Arnold is another, a number of black Confederates. And at the end of the war, he had 65 black troopers on the muster rolls of his cavalry. But this just shows that the progression, the change that Forrest went through, that he realized that the black Southerners, they could fight. They could do anything else anybody else could. And so this is where his personal opinion of the black Southerners, the black population, kind of evolved, that they could do the work, they could certainly fight. One instance in the had a black company of cavalry in the Battle of Chickamauga, participated in the charge to rout the Union infantry on part of the battle. And then after the war, certainly was a friend to the blacks and recognized their prowess and expertise and abilities, and he put them to work on the railroad, the Memphis and Selma Railroad, the Memphis and Little Rock Railroad. In fact, that's why you get the name Forest City, because it was just about almost the midway point from Memphis and Little Rock, named for him because he helped. But he hired 400 black Southerners to work on the railroad, but not only as laborers, but as engineers, architects, construction foremen, and then of course firemen and conductors on the trains themselves. So he developed their own skills and usage to society.
There's one comment, you mentioned Forest City and the railroads. We know he got into railroading. It was probably one of the biggest growth industries in the South after the war, repairing railroads, and of course they were far behind the North in development. And
pretty much
City,
destroyed at that point, too.
Forest City, I think he started a lumber operation over there. And what I smile because I know a little bit about business, not as much as the rest of you guys may know. But he was developing a vertically integrated business operation to cut the lumber for the ties.
For the cross ties.
And bring as much of that under his control as possible as a businessman. That's pretty sharp. That's what Andrew Carnegie and some of the others, Guggenheim, were able to do. John D. Rockefeller, they brought it all in. Of course, later on we got into the trust being busted up, but Forrest is on his way. He wasn't very successful with his railroads, but I still think that was a driving feature for him all his life, and that was to be successful, to not only seek the top for the fame, but to be a successful man. And I do think respect was important to him. I do think he wanted the respect, having come from the yeoman background that he had. Nothing wrong with being a yeoman, but I think that was part of the American nature, was to push your way on through and up.
And as you mentioned, his reputation and business acumen got him appointed as the finance chairman or as such with the city council or the alderman. Mm-hmm. He was an alderman for two terms, and then resigned to go back to business, and they passed a resolution congratulating him on his service. Mm-hmm. And begged him to come back. And pretty soon he did come back and served a third term. Mm-hmm. As a city alderman because he was so well respected.
And during this period of time as an alderman, he was police and fire.
Okay, yes, I knew that, but sure. I've forgotten about
and,
it.
And fire commissioner.
Yeah, and the way that works is back in the day, the majority of fire chiefs had very little business sense. And so this is how all the commissioners worked. You would bring in businessmen that were good businessmen. Mm-hmm. Who could help the fire chief fiscally and keep his department afloat from a financial standpoint. They let the fire chief take care of hiring mm-hmm. his own people and taking care of fighting fires, mm-hmm. and the commissioners helped him run the business.
Well, I think that's, he was a leader. He was a natural born leader of men, and there's some people are. You know, I think business schools teach now and have for the last probably 80, 90 years that you really don't have to be an expert at what your business is. You just have to be able to manage the ins and outs and the people working for you. And I think Forrest knew it from the ground up. But I think that was it. He knew how to manage men. And I don't think it was all fear. I think it came through respect. Mm-hmm. He was never asking anyone, war or peace, to do anyone to do something that he would not do himself.
You know, when he got into the slave business, he learned it from Bolton's. They trained him. Mm-hmm. At the time, their business was down at Adams and the riverfront.
Because they were
bringing in their their slaves.
And they were the first and largest slave dealer in the city.
They were the largest. In fact, they were not only the first and largest, the biggest in the city, but they were the biggest in the South. Mm-hmm. So that was the primary main trade item that was floating around out there at the time. more slaves were coming in and out of here because they were going to Arkansas and they were going to Mississippi and
down to Vicksburg and,
and everywhere.
Yes.
I need to regress a little bit, go back to the part where the blacks that served in Forrest's cavalry, not only did he respect and trust them because they stayed with him, but they eventually became part of his personal bodyguard, which was called the escort. And I've also read in several biographies where the black escort members were the one that guarded his tent at night when he slept. They had that much respect for General Forrest and the need to make sure he was safe.
And his trust in them.
That's right. And then mentioned railroads already.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more, but I also understood a quote General Forrest said one time that the railroads helped defeat the effort to form a Southern Confederacy.
Yeah.
He realized the value of the railroad and how they worked in the South especially. That's probably why he went in that business after the war was over, because he knew the South needed the industry to recoup.
I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but you made me think of this, to the pallbearer address, and where he addressed the former slaves, and he told them that they were free men now, they were citizens, and he said, I'm going to advise you to do what I advise my men at the end of the war, and that is to become good citizens. I'm not going to tell you how to vote, but vote. He strongly encouraged that, and he became very active in politics after the war. He attended the Democratic Convention in New York City. He used to go out. They used to have, they were called conservatives, and of course then there were the Republican
radical Republicans,
but the opposition were generally called the conservatives, and they would meet outside the city out of Hickory with weekend picnics, take the train out there. But I've always thought that address, advising his men to lay down their arms, to be good citizens, and I think, as he said, the government to which you have surrendered can afford to be magnanimous. And he told the same thing to the former slaves. He did not just say, go out there and get a job. He said, become citizens and go vote. And that is something that's so often overlooked. It's most often overlooked.
Yeah, it certainly is. In his speech to his soldiers after the surrender, he said, you've been good soldiers, now you can be good citizens. And like Dr. Couples said, the speech to the pallbearers, which is the predecessor to the NAACP, and Forrest was the first white guest speaker, featured speaker, to speak to the Pallbearers Association. Quite an honor, quite an impressive request that they respected him so much that he gave the keynote speech to the pallbearers' picnic. But and in that, he said that I am your friend and we are your friends, meaning the Southerners, Southern whites, along with the Southern blacks. And he said, if you need anything, then come to me and I'll help you. And one of the unique things, he gave a bouquet of flowers, the daughter of the president of the Pallbearer Association presented him with a bouquet of flowers there.
And kissed
thanks.
Him on the cheek.
Yes, and he kissed her on the cheek.
Yeah.
Yes, and which was unheard of in 1875, that a white man kissing a black girl on the cheek in public was just unheard of. But Forrest could get away with it because he was respected by both blacks and whites at the time.
Do you think for 1 minute that they would have invited him? There was 3,500 people at that. Would he have been invited to that thing if he hadn't been doing something right?
Yeah.
Well, I think, there's something that's often overlooked, and if you go back in the newspapers, you'll read among the former slaves are conservatives, and they're referred to as the conservatives, like the other conservatives, but they do not get much publicity, and the animosity between some of the Republicans and the conservatives, both along both color lines, got to be rather tight at times, and that's why I said they would go out to Hickory with the former slaves and the former Confederates to hold their convention so that they did not have fisticuffs break out with people coming down on them. Mm-hmm. And I cannot stress this too much. Forrest, I think, was a very pragmatic man. He knew the value of money. He knew what it took to get through this world. And the war was over. They had lost. He had lost his fortune, well over $1 million, if I understand correctly, and was going to rebuild it for his family. And we also forget he'd had a number of personal tragedies in his life. His father's death, his daughter, 4-year-old Fanny, died in, I think, what, 1856, or about 4 years. And then, of course, his brother, Jeffrey, who was very close to him, was killed in battle at Oklahoma.
Younger brother, yes. Yeah.
But you see how he reacts to everyone. They bury Fanny, and he gets on with the business at hand. His father died, he took over. And in the middle of battle, his fondest brother mm-hmm. was killed. And as he dies in the general's presence, he then gets on and presses on with the battle. I think pragmatism, intelligence, all of these are factors in his character that help shape the man that we're discussing, but we don't get a chance to look at them that much because so often he is a creation today of political activists. I do want to say something. I've said this before many times, especially in front of classes. Historians are, in a way, a pathologist. The job of an historian, either amateur or professional, is to look at the facts, set their own biases aside, look at the facts, try to corroborate the facts, put them together, determine what happened and why. The minute they start predicting what might have happened, otherwise they cease to be an historian. And as I've said to many classes, if I was that good, I'd be making a killing on Wall Street today to try to determine what might happen.
Then they become a novelist.
Then they become a novelist, yeah. So farce today, and this is beyond farce or any other, too many people like to use history for their own agenda. And that is, I think, how many people see him today because he is still a very big stick in the room or gorilla in the room when it comes to politics. Between conservatives and liberals.
These also are using history selectively.
Yeah.
We'll use this part of it because this part supports my cause, but I'm not going to look at this other part of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything that we've talked about applies to the way that he handled his slave business.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the Boltons were doing business, they didn't care.
They just bought and sold
anybody.
Didn't
care at all. When he got into the business and he had learned from them, but he made it better, he would go to Kentucky and Missouri where the better slaves were, and he would hand pick them based on strongest, smartest, best ability
healthiest.
To reason. Then he would hand pick them, bring them back to his farm in Woodstock and teach them trades to make them marketable. He would teach wheelwright, blacksmithing, farming.
Mm-hmm.
To the women, he would teach cooks. Mm-hmm. And he believed in keeping the family together because if the family were together, then one member wouldn't be always trying to escape and go find the members of the family. As a result, and since we're talking about not today's perception. Today we would be considering this as a human trafficking situation. But in 1855, we're talking about a product here, unfortunately. But that's what we're dealing with. But he sold instead of the Boltons would sell their slaves for $500 a piece. He was able to get $1,500, $1,700 for his slaves. So he actually was making more money than the Boltons were, and he took good care. I think he realized that you know there was some moral issues here, even though the federal government at the time, the whole world at the time, this was a business.
Well, that's true. It's today with our sensibilities, and even then there are people. Obviously, there's a great debate going on throughout the country after the earliest days of whether slavery should be tolerated or emancipated. It's the Great Awakening, the Second Awakening, Great Awakening. What slavery is an oppressed economic labor force. And it's held in place, obviously, by force. And but it was legal. And throughout the country, things do not happen. I think is it Jefferson or Jackson says that slavery was kind of like the young boy holding a wolf by both ears, wanting to let go but afraid to do so. And that's where the country was. Now, in our sensibilities today, it's hard really to put our mind there. But that's, if we're going to understand, for anyone else, James K. Polk, Ulysses Grant, if we're going to understand them, we have got to understand the world in which they live. And that's, as you're outlining, Joe, that is the world in which they live. And for us to now, or any other time, this is just, I think, for any historian, or any person who claims to be a historian, who applies judgments to another people of another era by today's standards is ahistorical. That is not history. And it's certainly right to evaluate them in the laws and the mores of their day. That's what we're supposed to be doing. That we're supposed to know that much about it to be able to say this was wrong then.
You analyze it in those times.
Analyze it in those terms. Now, I think certainly today we know it's wrong. And yet it goes on throughout the world today. The rest of the world knows it's wrong. But I just think these are very important.
But you know, he has, locally, he has taken the brunt and become the regional whipping boy. And at the time, there were 10 other people in Memphis. The family, well, of course, John A. Denny, who we know that name, got into the construction business and stayed there up until about 1988. And Witherspoon, the Delaps, the Crisp, the Isaac Neville, A.J. Cunningham, A. Wallace, all of these guys were selling slaves. Yeah. And after the war, they got into other businesses. They got into the cotton broken business, the grocery business, the building materials business. They just switched over from
one accepted business to different businesses after the war.
And every one of these people were fine people. They weren't criminals. They didn't have hidden agendas. The guys were in business of making money.
Part of the business community.
And that's all it was.
Well, it's pretty ironic that they're changing the name of streets from forest to forest with one R, but the Boltons have a school and a community named after them. The Whipping Boys always in the forest.
As Joe said, forest is the big target.
That's it.
And because he's the most prominent. And it's interesting, I heard one historian say that even 150 years later, these radicals and protesters still fear Forrest. Certainly because he's misunderstood, and as Joe said, only part of the history is brought up, and if you don't agree with it, then you don't bring it up. And so that's all the good things that Forrest, as his leadership, tried to rebuild the community, rebuild the South after the war, gets pushed under the rug.
He was so highly thought of, and this absolutely blows my mind that in the 1900s, the 1920s, 1930s, all these people that fought with him were still alive, and he was still thought of as the greatest hero of the South by everybody at that time.
And I you're right. I think the big problem is thinking back to what I'm saying, to contextualize it in its own content. Forrest, very success, and I think part of that could come from those days in that he's made bigger than life. He was a human being. When he died, he was close to about 100 pounds. Dysentery had racked his body. He was 6'3". He was a frail old man, or maybe old before his times for the disease, and very contemplative. But the forest, the image that we have, part of this is a wartime. He's one of the few turning victories in the Western theater. So he becomes larger than life. I think the reality is he's the man that we've been discussing. But can you imagine what it was like when General Forrest came home for everyone in the city? When he came back home, this is almost a mythic, Homeric warrior returning.
Yes, that's right. And he was, when the South was down, their backs were against the wall, he was always a morale booster because he was always winning. The citizens, the Southerners, could count on Forrest to win his battles, and he most often did. So he was kind of invincible, and like you said, he was just like the mythical Hercules.
Talking to a retired colonel the other day, been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we were talking about war in general. We wasn't talking about Forrest per se, but he said, look, let's just cut to the chase. War is our side ganging up to kill your side before you kill our side. That's what it is. Forrest understood it. Forrest made it a little bit more direct, but war was killing. And we can discuss the morality of it the rest of the night. It's a horrible thing. But if you're going to come out of the line, if you're going to bring your soldiers out of the line, you've got to whip up on the other guy and kill them before they kill yours.
It was all about killing, period. Whether you liked it or not, it was kill the enemy.
And that's what the colonel basically said to me, looking me directly in the eye. I said, that's what war is.
And that's what Patton said in his speech, too.
That's what Patton said. And World War II. And the rest of the Darien. It's killing the enemy before they kill you.
Yep.
Well, go ahead and mention now about what is studied at West Point.
A number of years ago, Al and I had the good fortune to talk with General Norman Schwarzkopf after Operation Desert Storm, and he mentioned that Forrest is still studied at West Point today, and that was one of the tactics that he used in Desert Storm was feinting one way and then going around the enemy and hitting him where he was weakest, getting there first with the most, essentially, which was Forrest's wartime maxim, getting there first with the most. And so he is still, his tactics are still studied today in West Point. Prior to World War II, it was said that even German General Field Marshal Erwin Rommel visited Oxford, Mississippi to study Forrest's battle at the victory at the Battle of Bryce's Crossroads. Though it's unconfirmed that Rommel was ever in Oxford, it's a good story. But there is some indication that at least some German officers did in fact visit and study the Battle of Bryce's Crossroads, which was one of the most crushing defeats for the Union Army. Forrest was outnumbered 3-1, yet totally routed the Union Army sent to invade Mississippi. So it's quite a battle to study. But it's one of those that is still studied today, 155 years later.
Well, I'm going to say, you know, it's Forrest is neither angel nor saint nor devil. He was a man of his times. If you want to understand him, you have to understand those times. To get the job done. And as long as we have wars to settle our differences, there will be Forrest, there will be Pattons. There will be Nathaniel Greens, there will be people like that who realize that war is about winning, and as far as said, war is fighting, and fighting means killing. And I think to really overplay him, mean, certainly I think you recognize the skills, and I think all the attributes we've talked about are not observed in every man, certainly to the level they were in Forrest. But I think he was smart, intelligent, I think he was very pragmatic, I was very capable, and he was very ambitious in his own personal life and for his family.
We were talking earlier about when he came home from the war and what a tremendous hero he was to the Mid-South. As most of y'all know, that Memphis was an occupied city from 1862 on through the end of the war and even in during Reconstruction time. Memphis had a lot of famous Confederates come to town because the business was thriving. We weren't a burn city like many of the southern cities were. And just think about it, I have a feeling that even with having Jefferson Davis here for several years, that Forrest was still the most revered Confederate in the city of Memphis until his death.
And you just have to look at that the time period when he passed away and his funeral procession attended. The procession was over 2 miles long from downtown Cumberland Presbyterian Church, then to Jeffrey Forrest House, out to Elmwood Cemetery. The procession was 2 miles long. There were about 10,000 people, you know, all of Memphians, who's who, and 3,000 of Memphis black citizens attended the funeral as well. 500 of them visited the viewing of the Forrest body in Jeffrey Forrest's house the night before the funeral. So it was just widely well respected among the citizens of Memphis. In discussing the political career, it should be noted that Bedford Forrest was chairman of the Democratic Party here.
1878. Talking about General Forrest and his career after the war was over, after he had already made a name for himself, he immediately came back to the Mid-South and went back to his cotton farm in Coahoma County, Mississippi, and started raising cotton and vegetables again. Interesting enough, he took on a partner that was a federal officer that served during the war, and before a couple of years were up, he actually sold out to that federal officer and sold out his cotton plantation completely. Came to Memphis. His first job here in town, he became president of the Planters Insurance Company, which was located on Madison Avenue, right across the street from the current First Tennessee Bank building, and I think the actual building is still there. That didn't really suit him. He was not one to sit behind a desk and manage an insurance company, so he was also, at the same time, operating as a cotton broker here in town, something he knew a lot about as from raising cotton. But right after that, he got into the railroad business, as we've discussed earlier, and his first attempt at that was the Memphis and Little Rock Railroad, which he was successful in completing, I believe, from Memphis to Forrest City, at least. I can't remember if it went farther than that. But Forrest City was his...
It went all the way across.
Forrest City was his railroad camp, and it was later named for him because of his efforts to complete that railroad. He was also in commercial real estate in Memphis. He bought and sold quite a bit of commercial property. His second railroad venture was the Selma, Marion, and Memphis Railroad, which he became president of, and was selling subscriptions, what they called it back in those days, to help fund that railroad, not only to individuals, but also to counties and public entities. That railroad somewhat failed in the financial panic of 1873, and Forrest had to step down. He then got into the levee construction business along the Mississippi River and was in partnership with his son, William Forrest, his only son. He was doing that and also established another cotton farm on President's Island during this time and operated that till the end of his life. What was unique about it was, we believe it was probably the first penal farm in this area, where General Forrest rented convict labor from the Shelby County courts to operate.
It was the first workhouse.
Yeah. He housed them, fed them, and he got paid I'm not sure it was a daily or a monthly rate for using the labor, but he took care of them completely, and they farmed the cotton farm. It was about a 1,000-acre farm, which is still a cotton farm to this day on President's Island.
His facility burned, and the footings, if you go down there, you can find the footings where his buildings were. They're still there.
He was a guy, but he wasn't too involved with that, but his wife Mary Ann always went to church and frequently took Bedford with her, but after the war they went every Sunday to Cumberland Presbyterian Church, and this is one of his changes, is the character of evolving of Forrest, and he learned to come to Christ, to believe in God, and became a Christian after the war. Became very devout Presbyterian afterwards.
You know, I have interaction with a lot of some ministers around town and activists that always like to demonize General Forrest, and I always like to get in their face, so to speak, and ask them, who amongst us are not deserving of redemption? General Forrest came to Christ in 1875, died believing in Christ and his Savior, and did everything he could for the last 2 years of his life to make his life better and more of a Christian path and asked all of his comrades to follow, stand up and fall on the cross before you pass away.
Well, in a way, and I would say this, Richard, there's really not a lot known about Forrest and the Klan. Forrest and the Klan is a subject that's been conjured up. So that's what, I think you're right. It needs to be mentioned. But how you mention, I think it is that there is, although he's often accused of being the Grand Wizard, or the first Grand Wizard, there's nothing that bears that out. There are, I think Morton claims to have brought him into the Klan at the Maxwell House in D.C. Others, but there is, and I think he testified in the, and I'll probably leave this in your hands, testified before Congress, with the House Judiciary, I think it was committee.
U.S. Congressional Investigative Committee.
Of the outcome of the war, that's right.
1871
and
73.
There has never been any, he testified being aware of it, but not having direct involvement with it. So I think that I agree with you. It needs to be mentioned because someone will. But when you start to say, well, what can we really pin on him in the claim? It's basically hearsay.
Nothing.
And most everything that comes out of it.
We have not been able to prove anything. And if we can't prove it, we ain't saying it.
No one else has ever said it.
No corroborative evidence whatsoever that Forrest was in the Klan, let alone a leader in the Klan. In fact, there's indications that they're proof that actually there are others that were the leaders of the Klan. But Forrest was not. There's no evidence of that whatsoever, that he was involved in it at all.
Yeah, I think the only thing we can conclusively say is that there are people who make these claims, but none of this, the most substantive historical documents are the investigations at the Committee on the Investigation of the War. That testimony stands. I've got a copy at home. You probably have copies, too.
The congressional investigation lasted 5 days and interviewed scores of witnesses.
Including
General Forrest.
Under oath.
Yes, for several hours.
Penalty of perjury.
But none of the witnesses mentioned that Forrest was a member at all.
He was indicted for treason, but never tried, if you want to bring that out. But I agree with you, but it's kind of like, give me something we can really put in there about him, but there's nothing.
No.
There really is nothing.
No.
There's just nothing really substantive.
Right.
I think that is more building on Forrest's reputation. You know, you don't do right and eat your oatmeal, General Forrest won't come get you. You know, just kind of he's a bogeyman. I'm serious. I think that, he is a larger than life figure when the war ends.
Right. And of course, the Klan essentially was disbanded in 1869 and just ceased to exist very shortly after that. But and of course we can get this into this in another session. But I think, like you said, that the reputation was Forrest could do this, so why don't you join?
For you to contemplate, do this acknowledgement, which I agree, I think it needs to be done. Forrest, the Klan image is pretty much a creation of a great deal of animosity towards him that still exists to this day. I think that would be a good topic of why Forrest.
We're planning on doing something with that, but we're also in the process of researching what the Klan's impact was in the 1920s when we had 10,000
And this thing probably conflates together, overlaps the modern
Klan. I am betting on it.
Yeah.
So I'll send you my paper.
Send it to the
three Klans of America, because there's a post-war one, then the 1920s, and then the 1950s.
Well, I will send you. I know Christian's got it. I'll send you. It's Paul Wang's. I did accept it, and so it's in.
Oh, good.
It's in the university, and of course, in the halls of the University of Michigan, where they have all these dissertation theses.
I did want to say one thing. Getting back to his wartime career, and not only was a master on the battlefield, but he also learned logistics through his business acumen prior to the war. He knew how to move men to get things done. He knew how to get supplies where they were supposed to be. And logistics was a big part of being a wartime commander and feeding those troops.
Every successful general is a master logistician.
Right.
That's Grant's one big.
So that's a very important part of his larger than life capabilities.
All right, that's our show. Hopefully this has made you think a little bit. Maybe you've learned some things, and maybe we've cleared up a few things. Join us next time where I have another great episode for you. Thanks for listening.